22-1203CR, State v. Daryl McDowell, is our case for today. And we have, arguing for Mr. McDowell, Christopher Zicciarella. You have 20 minutes. You have given Mr. Finley of the Frank Remington Center, University of Wisconsin Law School, 10. Mr. Weber, you'll do 25, and then you get another 5 in rebuttal. Everybody agree? Okay. Mr. Zicciarella.
Chief Justice, members of the court, counsel, good afternoon. My name is Christopher J. Zicciarella, and I'm here representing the defendant appellant petitioner, Daryl S. McDowell. There were two issues that were briefed to this court, and I'm going to try to take those issues sequentially as they appeared in the briefs, at least with regard to my brief. First issue being the ineffective assistance of counsel claim that was made by Mr. McDowell. Everybody in this court knows the famous standard that was set in Strickland v. Washington, adopted by this court in State v. Ludwig, whereby the defendant, or in this case my client, needs to prove not only deficient performance, but prejudice, that somehow the result would have been different given the fact that there was deficient performance. I don't want to spend a considerable amount of time on this issue because the state concedes on page 12 of its brief that it is not contesting the Court of Appeals finding based upon two points. And they specifically state that defense counsel shifting from question and answer to narrative questioning without advising my client beforehand. And the second reason why they're not contesting is the use of narrative questioning despite believing that my client intended to testify truthfully.
Counselor, just so you know, this court is not bound by concessions the state may make or not make. So if there's anything you particularly wanted to tell us about this, I personally would be interested in hearing it.
Okay. Well, I guess before I can get into that, we have to decide, and there is obviously a dispute in this case as to what standard should be applied to the circumstances for which trial counsel was under at the end of this trial, just before he put his client on the witness stand. And the Court of Appeals adopted a standard based upon knowledge. Everybody in this court and everybody in this room familiar with this case knows that there are several standards that the Court of Appeals could have utilized. They utilized a knowledge standard. And when I reviewed the Court of Appeals decision, I took it that there was a three-pronged test that they were applying to this knowledge standard, and I broke it down as follows. You not only have to have knowledge, but in order to get knowledge, you need to have an admission from your client, and after obtaining knowledge from the admission, you need to notify the court, let the court know what went on. In essence, what the court said was, you only know when the client tells you. After the client tells you, you need to let the client know, and you need to let the court know. As I indicated in my brief, that is the standard for which I believe is appropriate on behalf of my client in this particular case.
Counsel, that sounds nice and easy. And heaven knows I like things nice and easily understood. But what do you mean by knowing?
Well,
you need knowledge. Are you defining knowledge as an express admission from the client?
Yes, because, I'm sorry.
Need there be, is this a magic words sort of thing? Hey, I'm lying, or I'm not going to tell the truth, or that kind of express admission?
I guess you could frame it a variety of different ways, but if the client tells you, I'm going to get up there and I'm going to lie, or I'm going to get up there and I'm going to commit perjury, something direct that tells the lawyer when the client gets on the witness stand, he is not going to be forthright in front of that jury or that judge or that trier of fact.
Under Ethics 2000, the definition of knowing is this. Knowingly known or knows denotes actual knowledge of the fact in question. A person's knowledge may be inferred from the circumstances. Does that meet your definition of knowledge?
No, it does not. Because in the real world, and I say this and I don't mean to sound egotistical or crass, but in the real world, as a practicing attorney, having done this for close to 13 years, whatever my suspicions are, whatever my presuppositions may be about what my client is telling me, whether or not I believe my client is telling me the truth or not, whether or not I believe the story that he is going to put forth to the trier of fact, I can never know, even though I have suspicions, I can never infer and actually have knowledge based upon what he's telling me unless he tells me that he's going to lie. That's my position, because when you have a client, a lot of times they tell you a story and they tell you about what the facts are. And when you take that story and you apply it to the facts or the evidence that the state is going to put forth, sometimes you scratch your head and you say there's no possible way that that could have occurred, or there's no possible way that that could be truthful. Now, that may be my belief, but it's not for me as counsel to tell my client, I think you're full of beans, and I don't believe that you should put that before the jury. And given that fact, I think you're going to commit perjury. Without the client specifically telling you that he's going to lie, you can never really be a zealous advocate in litigation, because suspicions are not knowledge.
Counsel, so there's no other way under this standard beside the client telling the attorney that I intend to be untruthful. That is the standard, correct? Actual knowledge has to derive from actually hearing it from the client, correct?
That's correct.
Now, let me just ask you, because I think Justice Bradley, in citing Ethics 2000, and we're looking at 20.33, what if a lawyer finds out through other ways that the client is lying? Say, for example, I'm just going to hypothetically, wherein you're going to retain an expert. Say it hypothetically, it's a forgery case. And so you retain the expert, and there are 10 checks, and the client says, I never signed those checks, and I want to testify, and the expert says that in his or her opinion, there's no doubt that the client signed those checks. But the client still wants to get up on the stand. So you're saying, unless, now that you know that, but you should go no further, that's it. And there's no other way that you can determine this except the client saying, I'm going to be untruthful.
That's correct. And let me preface my answer with the following. We, in the legal profession and litigation, hear expert testimony all the time. In any type of a civil case, one expert says one thing, another expert says another. They're both dealing with the same issue, but it always amazes me how two different experts can reach two different conclusions.
Just because, even in DNA expert?
There's always room for error. I mean, regardless, even if it's one in 100,000, one in a million.
One in a quintillionth or something. Billion.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Whatever it may be, your tantamount responsibility is toward your client. That's the position of the appellant in this case. And even though an expert may tell you otherwise, if your client, once again, this is a position I'm taking, if your client tells you something that this is what happened, this is the truth, and you have expert testimony which refutes that, who do you go with? Do you go with the expert where there may be some margin for error, even as quintessentially small as it may be, or do you go with the client whom you owe your duty to? After advising him, hey, look, I got this evidence, and this evidence pretty much refutes what you have to say. Obviously, as a lawyer, you're going to confront your client with that information.
Let's take your case here. Client has become aware that it's going to be very hard to shake the evidence that it was his DNA. So he says to you, well, look, I didn't want to get him in trouble, but it's really my brother. And you say to him, DNA may be close, but it's a good enough instrument that it's going to tell the difference between you and your brother. Client says, oh. And then your client next day says, what about my twin brother? And you say, well, the DNA won't identify between you and your twin brother. And then you say to him, well, do you have a twin brother? And he says, no. The following day, he comes in and he's obviously looking for an explanation of how his DNA is in that spot, right? And the following day, he comes in and my mind's not fertile enough to think of another explanation, but he does. And you say, well, that won't work because, and the fourth day, he comes in and he has this story about his father and his girlfriend. So we are now umpteen stories away, and he prefaces all this with, I didn't want to get them in trouble. I didn't want to get my father in trouble. I don't want my girlfriend to have to testify, but this is the real truth, et cetera. Do you have knowledge?
I guess I'm inferring a couple of things into your hypothetical. And let me. If a client's indicating to you, well, what if this were the case, what if that were the case, what if this were the case, those are hypotheticals that your client is throwing out to you. And you're engaging in conversation.
No, he's not that sophisticated. He's saying, well, maybe, okay, go ahead. Okay.
And you're sitting down and you're advising him, well, if that's the case under your hypothetical, here's what we got. If that's the case under your hypothetical, here's what the evidence is going to show to refute that. All along advising him, when you take the witness stand, you need to testify truthfully. I think that we all owe a duty of candor to the tribunal. And you need to let the client know that. I'm not going to put you on the witness stand if, in essence, there's going to be perjury testimony. If the client comes out on the fourth day and says, this is what happened, not in a hypothetical format, I'm his lawyer. I've got to put him on the witness stand. He's got to testify.
You're a little suspicious.
Sure.
Counselor, as an officer.
Foundation.
Excuse me?
Do you have a firm foundation? Would it satisfy the state's burden?
Well, do you have a firm factual basis under those circumstances? It really depends upon how the client tells you that. And I guess I'm going to take this as point blank from the way you've given me the question. In other words, the client is giving you different scenarios, and you know as the lawyer, the guy's just fishing around looking for something that's going to work.
Exactly.
Okay. Do you have a firm factual basis at that point? Probably. I mean, you've got some doubt in your mind as to, by the fourth day, what he tells you, whether or not that's truthful or not. But by the same token, and I can't get off this, and I'm probably going to repeat myself a lot, it's a suspicion. It's an inference. Once again, what may be a firm factual basis for one lawyer, Chief Justice, may not be a firm factual basis for another. And it may be that I may believe I have a firm factual basis. It may be in those circumstances Mr. Finley believes otherwise, and perhaps Mr. Weber thinks otherwise. I don't want to sit here and beat a dead horse, but in this particular case, the state is conceding that there was a deficient performance, but yet if we were to adopt their standard, Mr. Weber would have you believe that counsel at the time had a firm factual basis under the law, if we adopt his standard, such that he should have taken corrective action.
Well, counsel, I mean, here, according to, I think, both briefs and the record, the client told the lawyer, Langford, he said, I'm going to testify untruthfully. I'll say what I have to. And then he discussed this, at least according to the Mockner hearing testimony, at length with Langford and with, I think, attorney Vishay, if I'm not
Vishay, Vishay, I believe, yes.
And so when they, so the defense counsel knew more or less what story the defendant was going to put forth here. Is that, if I misstated the facts, or am I, is there, I don't think there's any dispute about that, is there?
I believe you stated the fact that trial counsel testified to that fact at the Mockner hearing, but I also want to make every member of this court aware my client also testified, and he refuted having ever made that statement. So whether or not that's a finding of fact, that this court is accepting what trial counsel said. But yes,
oh,
he
no,
did
this
say
court,
that.
We're just, but I'm just stating what was said at the Mockner hearing.
Yes, that was indeed the testimony. I believe that came out by examination, on cross-examination by the prosecution.
Do we ever have to get to this issue if the trial court erred in failing to allow counsel to be excused and that new counsel should have been appointed?
No. This issue never should have arisen.
And your position is that there was an erroneous exercise of discretion because there was no exercise of discretion?
That's correct. When I read that transcript, I was, once again, this is a real-world setting. I can understand the trial court. You show up. It's, you know, the facts were pretty egregious. I'm sure the complaint, as I've read the complaint showed egregious facts. You want to get some finality, not only for the state, for the defense, but also for the alleged victim. When trial counsel showed up on the first day of trial and in essence said two things that I believe should have given rise to a Lomax colloquy, that being number one, my client has fired me. Number two, he's been unassisted. And the third thing that really kind of struck me was, when there was a statement made, and I don't have the record in front of me, but it was such that the opening statement was deferred because he really didn't have a theory of defense simply because his client was unassisted. And he made that known to the trial court judge. The law on this issue is very clear. If a substantial complaint is made by the defense, and I say the defense because I don't believe it has to be limited only to the defendant. Obviously, as a lawyer, you represent the client. If a substantial complaint is made that could reasonably be relied upon as a request for new counsel, a colloquy has to be engaged in between the trial court judge and the defendant. No colloquy was done here. If I remember correctly, I believe the statement by the trial court judge was, that's hogwash. I decide who gets hired and who gets fired, and that's going to be the end of it.
Now, when you look at the record, which you're reflecting to, this was the first day of trial. They had several hearings prior to that, and there was, would you say in this case there had been some delay or that they weren't or were not prepared? I think there were 3-4 hearings before that, as I recall in reading the record. Now, the state maintains that basically that there was nothing. McDowell was there, Langford was there, and nobody said anything. Well, he's not fairly representing me. The court said, you know, I'm going to give you an opportunity. No one gave him any reasons other than the one statement, which was, my client fired me over the weekend. And the state maintains that that is not enough, that that is not substantial. The jury was down there. This is the first day of trial. The judge is looking at a number of things. One is just in the interest of justice, of the victim, of the public. The jury is ready to go, and now I'm faced with this. This resonates throughout the record as I see it prior to that about the client and Mr. Langford not being on the same page.
That's a correct recitation of the facts. If I could respond?
Sure.
Getting back to what the Chief Justice said, in most instances, in this instance, you don't have clients that are all too sophisticated. And I mean no disrespect to my client. That's just the nature of the beast. What the state's position presumes is that the client is intelligent enough to get up in the middle of all of this colloquy or this statement between the defense lawyer and the judge and say, I don't want this guy. I don't want this guy as my lawyer. Basically, it puts the onus on the defendant himself to get up and say, hey, look, I want another lawyer. That's not what this is all about. This is about the lawyer acting on behalf of the client. And when the lawyer says, I have a problem, it's up to the trial court judge. Once again, this is the appellant's position. The trial court judge at that point knows that there's a problem. A, the lawyer's been fired. B, he's been unassisted. C, the lawyer doesn't even have a theory of defense. Why not simply take matters into my own hands as the head of this tribunal and ask the defendant, simply ask him, do you want this gentleman to be your lawyer? He would probably answer no. Why? He was never asked two simple questions. I don't believe that the onus should be on my client in this particular case, or any defendant for that matter, to have to take matters into his or her own hands and get up and say, I don't want this guy as my lawyer, or her, whomever it may be. Because you're the defendant in a criminal case. You're looking at trial. This guy was on trial for his life. And to put an onus like that upon him on the first day of trial, I think is unreasonable.
Counsel, why do you think there was prejudice in this case? I know that's a position you've taken in your brief. Obviously, the Court of Appeals didn't agree with you, and the state doesn't agree with you.
I thought long and hard about how I was going to answer this question, and I want to refer specifically to paragraph 66 of the court's decision. What the court stated was, we readily acknowledge that McDowell's testimony could have been enhanced and clarified through counsel's questioning. Here, however, the jury was able to consider McDowell's essential defense. Simply stated, despite the limitations of narrative testimony, McDowell presented his oral sex the night before defense to the jury. Let's face it, that defense was never put forth before this jury. There are ways to tell a story and there are ways not to tell a story. A lawyer in a criminal case acts as a director. Some lawyers do it better than others. I'd like to think that in certain cases I do okay. I know that there are lawyers out there that do better than me. But at the point in time where trial counsel decided to switch from a question and answer to a narrative, that client was on the witness stand for his life, effectively without counsel. It was an actual conflict of interest at that point. The lawyer, once he got the note from appellate counsel, was no longer representing my client. He was representing his own interests, basically protecting what he felt was ethical. And I don't want to get off the point. My point is this. If a lawyer was there, his trial counsel, to guide his testimony, that sex the night before defense that the jury came back with a poignant question on would have been put forth in more clarity, more definition, would have been more specific, and they would have had the opportunity to make a decision as to whether or not there was some plausibility with regard to him being in that alley the day beforehand.
Counselor, if in fact there was any plausibility in his testimony, and if we assume he had oral sex the night before, and that was the source of the semen that was found there, where is the third DNA, which should have been combined with the victim's saliva and the DNA of your client from the semen? Because if she was assaulted by somebody else and she spit it out, there should have been a third DNA there. Where's that, and how do you put that together no matter how good the lawyer is?
Well, I was never under the impression that that needed to be the case, so to speak. I mean, it could have been that there was an assault and that perhaps that particular individual's DNA never ended up in her mouth. I was always of the impression that the sample contained two, his and hers, and that perhaps maybe her testimony would not have been credible before the jury. Maybe it would have been that it wasn't oral sex. It could have been some other type of manner. That's really the only way that I can answer that. I don't know specifically enough about DNA evidence, DNA testimony, to give you a concrete example. And perhaps...
Counsel, can I just... Whose testimony before the jury? Who are you talking about? Whose testimony before the jury?
Excuse me?
Whose testimony are you talking about before the jury, just so I understand? You were talking about...
The victim, excuse me.
The victim?
The alleged victim, yes.
Okay. Right.
Perhaps what I would, the only way that I can answer that is you need to have an expert, some type of expert, take a look at this, and that would probably give me a better way to answer your question. I was not the trial counsel, and I don't know how I can answer that question without having some of that, at least expert advice given to me.
Thank you.
My red light is on.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Finley,
you have
10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. On behalf of the Frank J. Remington Center and the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, I'd like to thank Mr. Weber and Mr. Chiarella and the court for both permitting me to submit a brief in this case and to participate in this oral argument today. We asked to participate today because this case addresses an important issue governing the role of counsel in the criminal justice system and the relationships between counsel and client and between the counsel and the court. I'm here on behalf of amici to urge this court to adopt the standard announced by the Court of Appeals that with only extraordinarily rare exceptions, counsel may not conclude that her client intends to present perjury and accordingly may not abandon her duties of confidentiality, loyalty, and zealous representation unless the client admits to counsel an intent to testify falsely. We urge the court to adopt this position because I think it's really... It's the only rule that comports with the role of counsel in the criminal justice system. The role of counsel of the defense attorney is critical to the effective functioning of the adversary system. And we ought to be very reluctant to move away from that, to strip defendants of their right to representation by counsel, unless we absolutely must do so.
Counselor, in this regard, does defense counsel have any affirmative obligation to ask his client and question his client about the truthfulness of his story?
I don't know that counsel has an affirmative duty to ask. I think counsel has a strategic duty to make inquiries into the veracity and the believability of the story because, you know, one of the points I want to make here is that we really don't need a rule that requires counsel to act as truth finder before it ever gets to the jury. We have jury to do that.
I understand that, but we also have a process, though it guarantees a defendant a right to testify, it does not guarantee him a right to commit perjury. Our system operates based on the fact that people will tell the truth
yes.
when they are under oath. And so, you know, if we were to adopt your standard, does counsel have any obligation to inquire into that when he's getting his client ready to put testimony on the stand?
I don't know of any rule that requires that. I don't know that we should. What I was trying to say, and I'm sorry if it wasn't clear enough, was that I think there is a strategic responsibility for counsel to do something of that sort, because the real barrier, the real obstacle to presenting perjury is perjury most often is not going to sell. As a matter of strategy, counsel needs to know what the story is, and it had better be a good story, a story that's persuasive. If you look at what happened in this case, we didn't need counsel to withdraw. We didn't need counsel to back off. This story was one that the jury could see through without any help from counsel. And that's typically when it's going to happen. If it's not that clear, then counsel can't know that the client's testimony is false. And the client and counsel had better do his or her best to advocate on behalf of the client.
With all due respect, counsel, I think that there are a lot of defendants, though probably not this one, who commit crimes that are extremely sophisticated. They're probably smarter than most of us in this room, and they are able to tell stories that are totally credible to the hearer who may be persuaded by what they say. So I really go back to my question, if we adopt actual knowledge as the standard, is there any obligation on the part of defense counsel? Just yes or no is all I'm asking for.
No.
To inquire. No.
Okay. My answer is no, and my answer is no for this reason. If the story is credible, as you're suggesting, then counsel has no basis to start questioning the veracity of the client. And when this court starts intruding on that relationship by telling lawyers when they must ask suspicious questions of their client, it really is disruptive to that very, very difficult task of creating good client relationship, trusting relationship between client and attorney. I think it's best to leave it to the lawyer to figure out how to make inquiries with the client, how to develop that relationship.
Let me take it one step further, okay? So you don't think there's an affirmative duty to ask, what about if your client starts to tell you something and you can tell he's going to tell you that he's fabricating this story? You know, this is what I'm going to say, not to say it ever happened, and he starts to tell you what might have happened. Is the lawyer supposed to shut him up then, or what's the lawyer supposed to do?
I don't think a lawyer is supposed to shut him up. I'm sure some lawyers do. My problem with, and I know that the state has proposed its alternate standard because it believes it will address that problem. My concern is that if you have a lawyer who is bent on not knowing the truth, that lawyer is going to find a way to do that under either standard. That lawyer, in fact, is under the state standard, is going to probably be less likely to make the necessary investigation because that lawyer is not going to want to know what the investigation yields. Under the standard that the Court of Appeals adopted, that lawyer is going to investigate because that lawyer, even if the lawyer finds facts contrary to the client's story, the lawyer can still advocate on behalf of the client because the client has not admitted the perjury. So it seems to me that the standard adopted by the Court of Appeals is the one that both best comports with counsel's duties to his client, but also best advances the truth-seeking functions of a trial.
Mr. Finley, what do you think is meant by extraordinarily rare exceptions? I found that very interesting when I read the Court of Appeals opinion, and obviously that's what you're advocating as well with your statement.
Yes. I want to clarify one thing about that. That caveat that the Court of Appeals added to the admission of intent to lie standard is not one that I urged. It's not one that I particularly urge here because it seems to me that it starts us down that slippery slope towards the fuzzy question of when do you know you've got that rare exception and when don't you. I don't argue against it, however, and I'm willing to accept it because I think the Court of Appeals is probably right. There are some very rare circumstances when the truth is obvious, and in those circumstances perhaps we don't want to tie counsel's hands.
Would it be, and I gave this example to other counsel, DNA test, and comes back in the billions or quintillions or whatever, and what do you do with something like that? You're not going to use it, obviously. You did it, and maybe the other side isn't going, this is just a hypothetical.
Right, I'm glad you asked.
Is that a rare exception?
I don't think so. And that may seem a little funny at first, but let me explain why. I don't think so because for two reasons. Number one, again, you don't need counsel in that circumstance to smoke out the client because that DNA evidence is going to be there. The jury can handle that just fine. You don't need the lawyer to do it. But the other reason is because it's still possible. It's still possible that the lab made an error, that there was contamination. It's possible that there was fraud in the lab. It's possible they substituted samples. Likely? No. Possible? Yes. And shouldn't the client have his day in court in order to make that claim and let the jury decide that? There was a case in England a couple of years ago in which a lab report came back from the DNA lab saying that the DNA matched the defendant and it was 1 in 25 million chances of a random match or something like that. They hit on 7 different loci, a match at 7 loci. The defendant kept insisting, it's not me. They went back and tested 3 more loci. You know what they found? Those 3 loci excluded him. He was telling the truth. We can't rely on the experts to be the arbiters of truth because they may be wrong. They may not be telling the truth themselves. The client, the jury is the body that's best positioned to decide that. And if we take that away from criminal defendants, the right to present their claim in court, we're not advancing truth. We're just interfering with the constitutional right to counsel. My problem with the state's standard, which is that counsel must have a firm factual basis and engage in good faith, is that I really think it's no standard at all. What's a firm factual basis? Even the courts that have adopted that standard have applied it in dramatically different ways. The Eighth Circuit, for example, uses that language in, I believe it's the Long decision, but goes on to clarify that a firm factual basis only exists when the client admits, expressly admits an intent to lie. Other courts, such as the Mitchell Court from Massachusetts, says it's less than a beyond a reasonable doubt standard. What does it mean? And what aid is that to lawyers and judges in the trial courts who are figuring out what they're supposed to do? In this case, if we had a firm factual basis standard, would Attorney Langford have had any better idea of what he was supposed to do under these circumstances than he did before a decision setting that standard? I don't think so. I don't think so because there are, as Mr. Shirella said, there are many lawyers who under the circumstances of this case would conclude they have a firm factual basis. There are many other lawyers who would say, well, I have my very strong suspicions, but I can't say, and I don't have a firm factual basis. In fact, that's what Mr. Langford said. I have reasons to doubt, but I can't say because my client is telling me now that he's going to tell the truth. Now, developing the hypothetical that the Chief Justice raised, what if the client keeps coming in and trying out different scenarios, different hypotheticals that don't work? And in a way, that's kind of what happened in this case. Then he kind of hits on one that might work. Is that enough to give you a firm factual basis? Well, again, I don't think so, because as the Chief Justice's question suggested, there might be all kinds of honest reasons, all kinds of reasons why the client was making up false stories to begin with. He might have been protecting the girlfriend. He might have been protecting the husband. He might, the father. And it might be that he's trying all these things and ultimately in the end says, okay, here's the truth. How is the lawyer supposed to know which version is the truth? Even though the process looks very suspicious, it's entirely possible that the story the client comes up with in the end is the true story, and that story ought to be heard by the jury so the jury can decide, and if it's actually preposterous, if it's implausible, if it's even particularly doubtful, we should have confidence that the adversary system will sort that out and that the jury will make that proper decision.
I ask you a question here. In my first term on the court, we had a case, State versus Ryder, involved a drunk driving defendant who wanted a Miranda warning before he took a test. And he kept asking for that, and he said, that's not a refusal because I haven't got a Miranda warning. We said something in the opinion to the effect that it would be helpful if the police informed people about that they didn't have a right to a Miranda warning. Milwaukee Police Department made a poster with a passage from the opinion, and all you have to do is to look up there and say, you don't get a Miranda warning. Why wouldn't a poster be made? Don't tell me if you're not going to lie. Just look at that poster. Don't tell me if you're going to lie. And then I don't see where there would ever be any bar to putting in false testimony.
Again, I guess, is it possible some lawyers will use that poster? Sure it is. But again, I come back to the problem that adopting the state standard won't solve that problem. That lawyer will craft a new poster that says, don't tell me what happened at all, because I don't want to know. I want to be able to present the evidence, the trial that looks best to me. You're still going to have that problem. I think what we're doing is underestimating the integrity of the vast majority of the defense bar, who are going to say, I want to know the truth because that's the best story to tell. That's the story that has the biggest chance of succeeding. And I want to know everything there is about the case so that I can go out and investigate it and find the evidence that I need to tell my story of innocence. Are there going to be lawyers who use that poster? Yes. But they're always going to be there no matter what standard you adopt. So with that, I see that my time is up unless there are other questions. Thank you very much for letting me participate.
Thank you, Mr. Finley. Mr. Weber. Assistant Attorney General Weber, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, members of the court. The state asks this court for three holdings today. First, a criminal defense attorney must act to prevent client perjury if he has a firm factual basis to believe his client will lie on the stand. The second holding we ask for is that McDowell suffered no prejudice in this case from having to testify in narrative format. The third holding we ask for is that McDowell did not make a request for new counsel on the first day of trial. If this court disagrees with our position on that point, it should nonetheless hold that the circuit court did not err in failing to appoint new counsel.
Erroneous exercise, is that the standard for the last one?
I think it is a discretionary standard.
Okay. And no prejudice?
And no prejudice on the ineffective assistance. No prejudice from having to testify in
the burden
format.
Is on the defendant to show prejudice?
Yeah, a standard Strickland analysis, yes.
Okay. And what's the standard on the criminal defendant must act? If we whichever standard we adopt, is it de novo up here?
On the firm factual
yes.
basis?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Issues of constitutional fact, yes, I would assume a de novo review.
Okay.
The first issue is obviously the degree to which a defense attorney must be convinced that his client intends to commit perjury before taking steps to prevent the perjury. This is the key point of contention between the parties and Amici and the state. I spent a good deal of time trying to decide what the state's real interest is in this case, certainly in terms of the prejudice analysis and whether the defendant was prejudiced by what transpired at trial. But I spent a lot of time trying to decide what the state's interest is here. The quick answer, obviously, is we would like a standard that discourages perjury. But we also need a standard that protects the defendant's right to counsel and the right to testify. So there are competing issues at stake in this case. And the Court of Appeals recognize that. And they set what I consider to be, what the state considers to be, an absolute standard. A defense attorney has no duty to act unless his client tells him he intends to commit perjury. The exclusion to that the Court of Appeals presented, the exception to that, I suspect is such a rare set of occurrences that it doesn't bear serious discussion. The standard that they settled on demands too much. And Justice Bradley, I think, touched on that when she pointed out that in the Ethics 2000 manual, And in criminal law in general, knowledge and intent can be inferred from facts and circumstances. Knowledge and intent can be inferred, reasonably inferred, from facts and circumstances. And with respect to the Court of Appeals, their standard writes that out of the process, writes that out of the decision-maker's process, the trial counsel's process.
Counsel, one of the problems I have, as you say, you just said, knowledge and intent can reasonably be inferred from the circumstances. My concern is that when you say reasonable, you're probably referring to an objective standard. What would reasonably, that would be objective. And so often what's the objective standard as to reasonableness offers no certainty for those who are in the heat of the moment having to make a decision. The objective standard is in determining reasonableness is for those of us who sit up here and look back and say, oh, what would the reasonable person do after the fact? And that's not helpful.
And yet we ask law enforcement officers to define reasonable, articulable suspicions.
You know,
we ask them to articulate in that manner routinely in the decision-making process.
Absolutely. But I guess that's another day.
That's another day.
And so what they can reasonably infer from the circumstances. I mean, you're talking about a person's life on the line in terms of the defendant. You're talking about an attorney's profession on the line, arguably. And aren't they entitled to a little more guidance than the Monday morning quarterback, what would the reasonable person do, have done?
Every case that uses any standard other than one of actual knowledge, every law review article that discusses a standard other than actual knowledge stresses the point that it takes more than mere suspicion, more than a gut feeling, more than an inconsistency in story that could be explained by a failure of memory. Each of these courts that have adopted a standard other than the actual knowledge standard have all stressed that there has to be a firmly rooted factual basis for defense counsel, for criminal defense counsel to act. There are only, I have read probably 36 law review articles and at least as many cases. I have only found two standards one standard that's wholly objective, and that's the standard that the Court of Appeals settled on. Defendant has to tell you he's going to lie. The only other standard that I found where they articulated what I would consider to be an objective framework for decision was a law review article found in Volume 2 of the Georgetown Journal of Legal Ethics at page 579. The author's a law professor named Edward Kimball. He advocated proof beyond a reasonable doubt, a proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And he basically said, I believe that a defense attorney has an obligation to act to prevent perjury when, if he were the trier of fact in a lawsuit, a criminal lawsuit, if he were a trier of fact and had all the evidence before him that he had serving as the defendant's counsel, including the stuff that he would know but that a jury would never hear about, if a defense attorney under those circumstances, if it would be his duty to convict his own client of perjury. That's the test that this professor tried to articulate. And I'm not sure it's any better than the firm factual basis standard, but it shows the degree of difficulty that the courts and the commentators have had in trying to articulate a standard that would work here. And the state's problem with this is simple and straightforward. The standard that was settled on by the Court of Appeals doesn't take into account facts and circumstances short of a direct admission that create what in most prosecutors, I think in most of us, would be an indication that this guy, if he testifies, he's going to lie.
This is my problem. And so I focused on your statement and reasonably infers. And so the reasonable and to me sometimes the squishiness, for want of a more legal term, of that phrase. Again, I refer to Ethics 2000, and I'll read an excerpt which underscores to me, I don't know, all these words, what do they mean? And it's this.
Justice, when you say Ethics 2000, are you referring to the Supreme Court rules, or is this another document?
I'm sorry. It's a proposal on the ABA proposal with regard to. So, and I will read it briefly to you, and I think it will make my point. The rule that they're espousing here in Ethics 2000 does not permit a lawyer to refuse to offer the testimony of a client Now, this is where I'm getting to. Where the lawyer reasonably believes but does not know that the testimony will be false. They use so many negatives there. What they're saying is, if the lawyer reasonably believes that the testimony is going to be false, that's not enough. The lawyer has to know that the testimony will be false, but then you get to the definition of no, and it can be inferred from the circumstances. So they're saying here, if the lawyer reasonably believes it, that's not enough. So this reasonableness, this object, you know, where does all this stuff fit in? And it kind of gets me to, why not I don't know what this means. Why not a bright line rule so that everyone knows what you're dealing with? And I don't care if you're bright line, I don't care what level, if it's high, medium, and low, just make it bright. That's what I'm for.
And it bothered me, well, the way the Court of Appeals decided this, of course, Attorney Langford would have had no reason to act to prevent client perjury because his client never admitted that he was going to lie. The seminal case on this issue from the United States Supreme Court is Nix versus Whiteside. My guess is that Nix versus Whiteside would have also been a case where the defense attorney had no obligation to take affirmative steps to prevent client perjury because his client never said, I'm going to lie on the stand. Here we had a guy, and I want to get the quote right. Record item 79, page 103. What if Sunshine and I get together and say? And Attorney Langford interpreted that as an offer by his client to meet with Sunshine, the girlfriend, to get together and settle on a story. Record 79, pages 108 and 109, and this is cited in the state's brief. I'll say what I need to say to help myself out, and if I have to say something untruthful, I'll say that. I need to help myself out. That, combined with the physical facts and circumstances, the girlfriend providing an explanation of sexual activity that was wholly inconsistent with the facts, the fact that Mr. McDowell offered this theory of how his semen got at the crime scene only after the defense, Attorney Langford, pointed out to him that the scientific evidence, the state's DNA evidence, was virtually unassailable. Under these facts and circumstances, a reasonable attorney, a reasonable defense attorney, like Attorney Langford, could look at this and say, my guy is going to get up there and he is going to lie his pants off.
But don't these facts include then that he subsequently told his lawyer that he was going to tell the truth? So go figure.
and that's why, with respect to a point that Justice Rogensack made in Mr. Chiarella's argument, the state is not disputing the performance standard in the Supreme Court. We did in the Court of Appeals. We did argue that Attorney Langford acted in a reasonable professional manner in the way that he handled this situation that was presented to him. We made basically two arguments on that point. We argued first that Attorney Langford had discussed at length with Mr. McDowell what would happen if McDowell did lie on the stand, that you would be on your own. I can't assist in that. I can't help with that. You will have to do it in narrative format. I'll give you your wide open argument. The second point we made is that under State versus McMahon, which is, I think, at 186 was second, a defense attorney is only obliged to act in, let me rephrase, counsel's duty has to be well settled at the time of performance in order to claim that a defense attorney acted unreasonably. Counsel isn't expected to be omniscient. Counsel isn't expected to predict changes in the law. The defense, it basically restricts down, and I wish I had the language in front of me. I do. Yeah.
What page are you on, counsel?
I'm in my Court of Appeals brief, Chief.
I've got that, too. Okay, what page?
Page 13, footnote. In both Oswald and McMahon, this court, the Court of Appeals, made it clear that, quote, ineffective assistance of counsel cases should be limited to situations where the law or duty is clear such that reasonable counsel should know enough to raise the issue. We argued in the Court of Appeals that since all we had basically was Nix versus Whiteside, we didn't have state authority on how defense counsel should have proceeded, that basically if counsel performed in a reasonable manner, he should not be held to a standard that the Court of Appeals would create in the context of the case. It's probably charitable to say that the Court of Appeals didn't find my arguments persuasive. They focused instead on the fact that at the time that that Mr. McDowell took the stand, his attorney believed he was going to testify truthfully. Langford told the court that, testified to that. And secondly, that he moved from question and answer format to free narrative without any kind of briefing to the client. If you go back to the history of the case, the facts of the case, you will see that there are two or three prefatory questions, a sidebar, and the free narrative after that.
So you don't think the conversation he had with him earlier on, that if you get up there and you start to lie, you're on your own, is sufficient? You think he had to stop when he started to, when he began to believe that he was going to lie and ask for an adjournment so he could tell the client at that point? Is that what you're telling me?
I think that would have been the better procedure.
But is it deficient not to do that?
I made the argument in the Court of Appeals. It met with zero support there. I didn't think it would fare better here. And frankly, under Strickland, if we can prove no prejudice, we don't have to address the performance.
But, you know, that may be the case. I always have a problem when the state gives up on things, because I count on you folks to argue them very vigorously on both sides, because it helps me out tremendously. And whether it sells or it doesn't sell, I'm always sad when you don't do that, frankly. But
I apologize.
Apologies necessary.
Counsel, I want to go back to one of the issues that Justice Bradley raised and look at SCRs, which you thought she was reading from, because they're some substantially similar, but there's some difference. A no is defined the same way, denotes actual knowledge of the fact in question. A person's knowledge may be inferred from the circumstances. 20:3.3, which is cited in the briefs, says a lawyer shall not knowingly offer evidence that the lawyer knows to be false. 20:3.3c says a lawyer may, doesn't say shall, a lawyer may refuse to offer evidence that the lawyer reasonably believes is false. So that seems to leave it up to the lawyer as to what to do if he or she reasonably believes. But it would be a violation of the code, I assume, if the lawyer knowingly offers evidence that the lawyer knows to be false. Is that how you read all this?
It is. It is. And the Court of Appeals attempted to reconcile that difference in language and approach.
And the Ethics 2000 may add another factor, but we're not into that yet. So that's how they try and reconcile A and C, although you can read A just to mean knows means knows. And although there's an inference, it's not drawn very readily, because if there's a reasonable belief, which is the objective test, you're into discretion on the lawyer's part. So now that we've sort of talked about that, my real question is, do these ethical standards, what's the effect on a trial of a violation of the ethical standards? In other words, in our, and I may be overstating this, so don't take me at exactly what I'm going to say, it's arguable that you can violate the judicial code in some ways, and yet the trial that you, or the proceeding in which you sit, will not be overturned.
Yes, that's correct. There's case law. I'm not sure if there's case law from this court, but there's certainly federal case law that stands for the proposition that the ethical rules are not performance standards for purposes of
that's what I'm asking you.
For purposes of Strickland analysis, ineffective assistance.
Right. So regardless of what SCR says, you're going in, if I understand the argument and I understand defense counsel, in terms of the criminal law doctrines, you want a, since I have already misstated it, firm factual basis.
Yes.
Regardless of what 3.3 says.
Certainly for the context of Sixth Amendment analysis, we'd be asking for the firm factual basis standard. I don't see a reason why the firm factual basis standard couldn't be applied to the rules of the Supreme Court rules, the rules of ethics, in the same manner that the Court of Appeals reasoned its way to interpreting them with the standard that it settled on.
Whatever the standard is, it seems to me there's probably going to be a lot of lying going on.
Lying? I'm almost more afraid of the silence than the lying. You raise the possibility of a poster, somewhat facetiously saying, don't tell me you're going to lie. Don't tell me what you don't want me to know. I'm concerned about that, and it's not lost on me that I am the only person at counsel table here who has not defended a person accused of a crime. But I have worked around courtrooms all my life, and I know that there are individuals who do the dance in briefing their client, in explaining to their client what to tell me and, more importantly, what not to tell me. And I gave an example in my brief of a colloquy, a one-way colloquy, that a defense attorney could have with his client, a briefing, and frankly, a briefing that a defense attorney may be obligated to give his client. I don't know. We would need interpretive case law to know if a defense attorney was ineffective for failing to inform his client that if you don't tell me you're lying, I can put you on the stand, but if you tell me you're lying, I have to take all of these steps to ameliorate the possible perjury.
Okay.
Why not just eliminate the standards and let people lie and then put the onus on the people who lie, not on the attorneys?
Professor Friedman, that is an approach that more than one or two commentators, not courts certainly, but commentators have suggested that the defense attorney's ethical obligation, or that the defense attorney's obligation under the Constitution to his client means that you put on whatever your client says that he wants to testify to. That point of view is most quickly attributable to Monroe Friedman, and there are a couple of law review articles that he has written where he puts forward that hypothesis, that it's the responsibility of the defense attorney to present every argument.
And it gets rid of a lot of these problems, which he views as making distinctions without any differences, and that all you're doing is fostering a lot of silly arguments instead of just getting right to it, letting it all hang out there, et cetera. It's not a position that I necessarily take, but it's one I have heard him express.
It's the most extreme. And again, in the Court of Appeals, when we were arguing what the procedure should be, there were basically six possible responses. The first was do nothing. The last was, I believe, immediately withdraw. And we considered the two extremes to be the most unworkable positions.
You all are probably post-date this, but there's a very famous book written by a former justice of the Michigan Court, and I think I'm right in my literary allusion, called Anatomy of a Murder, in which the lawyer tells the client what the defenses are and explains all the legal basis for this whole, for whatever the crime was, I think it was murder. And then he's got a very smart client, as I remember, a military officer. And then the client listens carefully, and then the client gives the defense counsel what happened.
Yes, and the, as I recall, the basis was to lead him to an insanity defense, or a defense of diminished capacity.
I don't know what the defense was, but I remember that, and that there have been significant debates as to the ethics of that.
I have concerns. I have concerns how this absolutist standard of the Court of Appeals will play out in the real world.
The real world is mushy.
If the real world is mushy, then this court ought not hesitate to adopt the firm factual basis standard as applied in Mitchell and.
But if you want mushy, firm. What is firm? Firm to whom? Reasonably firm? Objectively firm? Factual. What kind of fact? You know, I mean, is it a fact inferred? Is it a fact reasonable? You know, so
you ought to make that same argument as to what knowledge is.
No.
And what is an admission? Or don't you make that?
It's been a long time since I've been in a philosophy classroom.
Surface here and now. That's the only thing that's real.
I don't want to get away from the standard because I think it's obviously very difficult, and maybe a bright line looks brighter as I listen to the argument. But in any event, my question goes to the presumption of prejudice. I just want to talk about that for a minute. I was just reading on page 9 the narrative that the defendant stated before the jury. And I was thinking before this what happened. Langford had an expert, a DNA person, and he decided based upon, in his opinion, he didn't want to put him on.
Right.
He talked to Sunshine, and based on his observation, he didn't put Sunshine on because they had a conflicting story. In the narrative, they talk about the defendant's father. And he didn't appear either, as I recall. So the defendant got up on the stand, and he talked about his father. He talked about Sunshine. He talked about how the semen got into the alley. But there was nobody but himself. And the argument is made by defense counsel here, opposing counsel, that he just abandoned his client. What about that? Presuming prejudice.
Well, first and foremost, the state takes the position that there should be no presumption of prejudice in this case. The Court of Appeals' analysis focused not only on the narrative testimony of the defendant, but how the defense attorney in opening and closing bracketed the time frame. The essential elements of his defense were non-involvement, that I had consensual sexual contact with my girlfriend the night before. That's how my semen got to the crime scene. There was a basis, had the jury believed this version of events, there was a basis for the jury to conclude that the defendant's semen got to the crime scene because of this consensual sexual contact with his girlfriend the night before. Defense attorney also used some of the state's evidence in regard to how DNA is distributed, dandruff, skin flakes. A jury could have worked its way to a conclusion that the DNA got to, if they didn't believe the defendant, that the DNA got to the crime scene because DNA migrates off of bodies. You have hair follicles, you have skin, you have other substances that secrete DNA. First and foremost, and I'm in the red and I understand if I can finish.
Continue to finish the question.
Two cases from this Court's own jurisprudence that I think control the presumption of prejudice. The first is Erickson, where this Court says that prejudice will only be presumed in rare cases, and more importantly, Smith, where this Court says that part of the rationale behind presuming prejudice is the difficulty in measuring the harm caused by the error. There's no difficulty here. There's no difficulty in evaluating the absence of prejudice in this case, given the claim that the defense made. The defense said I suffered prejudice because I wasn't able to put my defense before the jury. We know that that's not true because we can see it in the record.
I just want to point out, you won in the trial court, in the Court of Appeals, and so you're here defending the ultimate win, but you want us to change the legal doctrine in this first issue.
We won in that the court found no prejudice. The manner in which they resolved
is one that you disagree with. Okay.
Only the standard. The court spent a great deal of time going through the mechanics of what has to happen. We're in essential agreement with that.
Justice Bradley.
You mentioned Erickson, and I don't have that before me, but for the premise that prejudice will be presumed only in the rare cases. And my guess is then it talks about maybe structural error in a rare case where there's a presumption is a biased judge.
I think it runs the chronic, the examples in chronic.
Yes. And does that include, it's not CH, does that include no counsel? I can't remember if that list in chronic includes no counsel, which
chronic,
is ineffective assistance of counsel to equal this.
Chronic actually, that's where the term constructive denial of counsel was first found, I believe. Chronic talks about actual or constructive denial of counsel. The only argument that could be made here is that there was constructive denial of counsel. We don't believe that there was. The defense attorney was there. The manner in which the questioning occurred did allow him to put the essential, him, McDowell, to put the essential elements of his defense before the jury. Counsel in both opening and closing bracketed historical facts that would have enabled the jury to reason its way to a finding of acquittal. I thank the court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. Mr. Chiarella, you've got 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I'm glad that the presumption argument came up because I didn't get to address it initially speaking. I do want to address that argument right now. Erickson is the case that was set forth by this court that sets forth those rare instances where this court will presume prejudice. There were three instances that I put forth in the brief that came from other jurisdictions. And basically what each of the, and I'm going to make it as simple as I can. Those instances where other courts have said that there is or should be a presumption of evidence is, number one, where there is an actual conflict of interest between lawyer and client. Number two, when counsel is present but is not functioning as counsel. And third, where there has been a denial of counsel at a critical stage of the proceedings. I don't believe that there would be I guess there is a disagreement between Mr. Weber and myself. Mr. Weber does not believe that there was no counsel present at the point in time where my client was on the witness stand, and in essence there was a break in the trial, a colloquy was had with the judge, and then it was a direct switch to narrative. I don't know how else you can interpret that other than the fact that at that juncture there, A, was not counsel at a critical point in the proceedings, and B, there was an actual conflict of interest between lawyer and client. And I know I said this before, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but this gentleman was on trial, in essence, for his life. And at the point in time where there is a switch from question and answering, or question and answer questioning directly to a narrative, he doesn't have a lawyer present with him. He doesn't have an advocate present with him. He is, in essence, on his own. The reason why he is on his own is the note that came in, the note that changed the whole game.
But, counsel, if we buy your argument and we take another case where the client says, yes, I'm going to lie, and he gets up on the stand to testify, as is his right, and counsel's hoping he won't lie, asks one or two questions, and he then counsel does what he said he's going to do, lets him testify in the narrative, but there's no question that he's told counsel he's going to lie, and there's no equivocation, as there is according to your early statements to us in this record, then why isn't prejudice presumed there?
I'm going to assume...
Narrative is the form of choice if you know the client's going to lie, right?
This gets back to the earlier question that you posed to Mr. Weber that I believe is crucial to this factual scenario. At the point in time where there is a switch from Q&A to narrative, and I hate to use anagrams, but...
That's fine, I understand.
Okay. I feel, this is what I would have done. I would have stopped that trial right then and there. I would have asked the judge, I need to speak to my client and let him know that if we're going to go to a narrative, this is the way the game's going to work. And I hate to use that word, but this is the way it's going to work. You're going to get one question, and you best get everything out. You better tell that jury what happened the day before. You better tell them what happened in that alley, the fact that you didn't have a condom, the fact that you ejaculated, and the fact that you must deny to that jury that you ever committed this sexual assault. Because if he's told you that before, you let him know you get one question, you get one shot, and that's it. That wasn't done here.
Well, it was done, but it wasn't done at the time of trial. It was done earlier on, according to my understanding of what the facts are.
If we take what defense counsel stated at the Mockner hearing on its face.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you.
That's the inherent difference insofar as at that point in time, you have advised the client, you've acted as the advocate that you were appointed or hired to do. You've let him know, okay, here's what happened, here's what you said, here's the way it's going to work from now. At this particular point in the trial, in this case, that was not done. There was no counsel, and in essence, he was on his own. That is a Sixth Amendment deprivation of counsel, and I believe that factual scenario comes under two of the instances under Erickson, which this Court has previously enunciated. Number one, when the effective assistance of counsel has been eviscerated by forces unrelated to the actual performance of the defendant's attorney. The note itself, in essence, took the lawyer out of the fray, so to speak. The second one is where the actual assistance rendered by a particular attorney has been deemed so outside the bounds necessary for effective counsel that a court has presumed prejudice. Not stopping that trial, not consulting that client, not letting him know that he was on his own at that point, that in and of itself was a situation that made it very, very egregious. I believe that's something that should not have occurred. Before I get into some other issues, two other issues I do want to point out, and I didn't realize that perhaps Amici and myself would have some disagreement, and I apologize for not having mentioned this in my initial argument. I didn't like that language, extraordinarily rare circumstances. If I could conclude, I'm on the...
Thank you.
I don't know what that means, and if I don't know what that means, I don't know what a practicing lawyer is going to know what that means. You're adding a subjective element to an otherwise objective test. And as I said before, when you have a bright line rule, it makes it workable. It makes it simple for practicing lawyers. The Chief Justice said that the real world is mushy. It is mushy. A bright line rule makes it a little bit easier. I'm not here to suggest that this court should make my life easier, or any other lawyers for that matter, but if we have a standard that's workable and makes it a little bit simpler for us and easier to apply, rather than having to work our way through the mushiness and the murkiness, it may make the litigations go a little bit easier.
Thank you, Mr. Torella.
Thank you,
Mr. Weber, and thank you, Mr. Finley, for your argument on an issue that we haven't faced before. And it's an interesting one. So that concludes 02-1203-CR, State v. McDowell. This morning I said to you, Mr. Weber, are we meeting with the students? I think it's this afternoon. Are we meeting? Thank you. All right. I'll be right out. And you know the ground rules, nothing about the substance of the case, just procedure. And you'll be there as well as counsel in opposition. Thank you. All right.